from WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, young and female in the U.S. Army serving in Iraq. We talk with Kayla Williams. Her new memoir answers a lot of questions most people have about women in the Army, from what it's like to serve in wartime to what it's like being surrounded by hyped-up, horny men. She also writes about being asked to assist in an interrogation by saying sexually humiliating things in Arabic to naked prisoners. Williams spent about a year in Iraq as an Arabic linguist with the 101st Airborne. Also, Catherine Keener's performance in The 40-Year-Old Virgin gets our critic-at-large John Powers thinking about roles for offbeat women in Hollywood. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Kayla Williams, has written a memoir about what it's like to be young and female in the Army, serving in Iraq. She writes about the terror and the tedium of war, and the camaraderie and sexual tensions between the women and the men in the Army. And she describes the time she was asked to assist in an interrogation and was told to say sexually humiliating things in Arabic to naked prisoners. Williams served in Iraq as an Arabic linguist on a signals intelligence team with the 101st Airborne Division. Before enlisting, she'd already learned a bit of Arabic through a former boyfriend who was a Muslim. She enlisted in 2000 at the age of 23. Her friends were surprised. She'd been part of the defiant punk rock scene when she was younger. Williams was sent to the Gulf in February 2003 and returned from Iraq in February 2004. Her new memoir is called Love My Rifle More Than You. Now, you write that 91% of all Army career fields are now open to women. What are some of the things that are open that might surprise us and some of the things that are not?
Women are mechanics, women are military police, and women in intelligence jobs can serve in infantry and artillery units as well. It's very complicated how it's laid out, what we can and cannot do. But the main jobs that are closed to women are the actual combat arms jobs of infantry, artillery. We can't be tankers, but almost everything else is open to us. We can't be rangers or special forces, but we can act in support positions in special forces units.
So you were not officially serving in combat, but did you feel at times that you kind of were in combat?
Actually, I was officially serving in combat. I'm not in a combat job. I'm not in the infantry. I'm not a grunt. However, I was right there with the in an infantry division with infantry units, infantry companies, infantry platoons during combat. But everyone in the military knows, and I believe that most Americans know, that women are in combat. I've actually talked to a lot of people who are surprised to hear that we're not supposed to be in jobs that are combat jobs, like the infantry. There are a lot of people who don't actually know that. We get the same compensation, and in general, we get the same recognition from people who understand, although I've gotten very funny questions from people who do not understand, such as, did you carry a gun?
And the answer is, of course you did.
Of course I did. We were in Iraq. I wouldn't possibly go there without a gun. But to be asked that shows me that there are definitely some people, and they tend to be a little older, who really do not understand.
You write in the book that you love your gun. You love the smell of it, the smell of cleaning fluid, of gunpowder, the smell of strength.
Yes, at the firing range, that's definitely true. And basic training is when that was primarily, I became really came to enjoy firing, because it was the one time that drill sergeants really just left us alone to do what we were doing. And in Iraq, it just became much more of a tool, something that you use or pray not to use and have to carry with you all the time. And it just became such a constant presence that coming home, it was very strange to not have it all the time.
You write in your book that you knew you were there to help people in Iraq, but you often felt like you were hurting them, or at the very least that they perceived it that way. And you write about the tension of wanting to help the locals, but having to do battle with them. You say you even pointed your weapon at a child. What was the circumstance that made you feel you needed to do that?
We were on a convoy. At this point, we didn't even have doors on our vehicles. We didn't have up-armored Humvees at all in my unit, and we would remove the doors so that we could have better use of our weapons. The way that people drive in Iraq is very aggressive, and people will try to pass you by driving down the middle of the road, like the grass between the two sides of the road. And sometimes people will cut between your vehicle and the vehicle in front of you, and then somebody will come out of the trunk and throw grenades at your vehicle or pop up and shoot you. The man who is now my husband had already been very grievously wounded in an IED explosion while he was on a convoy. And we were driving. I was in the back seat behind the driver, watching my sector, and there was a vehicle driving very aggressively to our left on the grass, trying to cut in front of us. And I had no idea why they were doing this, if they were just in a hurry or if there was an actual threat. And I'm motioning to them with my weapon to stay away from us, to not get too close to us, to not try to cut us off. But they were continuing to drive very aggressively. And I was raising my weapon into the aiming position because it was a very intimidating and intense moment. And then the passenger turned and looked at me, and it was a child. And I immediately lowered my weapon. I was horrified. I felt very guilty. And I waved at him, and he waved back. And it was just one of those moments when I felt this intense disconnect between what we were supposed to be doing and what we were actually doing and what was going on, and the difficulty of trying to protect yourself and your my colleagues and having to try to make a difference in people's lives at the same time.
You know, so many men are brought up to be protective of women, and you wanted to be an equal in the military. Did men in your unit did they have that instinct to protect you, and did you have to stop them from doing it? Was that an issue at all?
I never noticed that tendency, but I was not generally in situations where it might have come up. I've talked to men who are in the infantry or artillery who say that they are concerned that in a firefight they would want to protect a female soldier more than they would want to do the mission, or that they would be distracted by the presence of a female and their desire to protect her and let the mission fall by the wayside. But I don't know how much that's actually true, because when you're actually in the middle of an intense situation, you tend to focus so much on just doing what has to be done. So I don't know.
You write about being a young woman with young men who are mostly away from women, except from the other soldiers in their unit. So that makes you kind of an erotic magnet, even in the most unerotic of circumstances. Can you talk a little bit about how men who you were working with related to you as a sexual being? In other words, here you were, I mean, here are all these horny men, you're the woman. So how much was that acknowledged?
It varied so much, and it was so interesting to me when I could have the distance to look at it from outside almost and watch what was happening. And I definitely noticed that the men that I went out with in Iraq on combat patrols, who saw me doing a service that was incredibly useful to them when I translated for them between the soldiers and the civilians, which is not my job, but I did with pleasure, they always treated me as a soldier. And even months later, when they would see me, they would say, "Hey, you are our linguist in Baghdad." They always remembered me for my ability to do a job that was helpful. But men who did not get to see me doing a useful job and saw me infrequently definitely thought of me as more an object or just a girl. "Hey, you were that chick that was with us in Najaf," or something like that, and very much would sexualize me and the other women that I worked with, coming up to us and offering us coffee or just wanting to talk to a girl. Went on and on and on, never a moment's peace, it sometimes seemed like. And then the guys on my own team, the guys that I served with and lived in the same truck with and was with every single day, really, it just disappears in a sense almost. They're more like your brothers or close friends. You see them constantly, and it's funny because they almost don't want to acknowledge that you're a girl because they work with you so closely. I remember one point up on the mountain, they said, "Don't stand where the wind blows the smell of you to us right after you've taken a shower," when you actually smell like a girl in America. "We don't want to smell your lotion or your shampoo. Go away." because they had gotten to a point where I didn't seem like a girl, but that was such a poignant, like, forced reminder. And it was just very interesting to see different people treating it different ways. It seemed almost as if guys in intelligence wanted to pretend that we were the same more, whereas combat arms guys were much more willing to say, you know, wow, you have boobs. I want to look at them. They were very blunt about it. Just no shame about acknowledging the fact that there were pressures and that they had desires. Even if they weren't going to do anything about it, just to be like, whoa, boobs, I haven't seen them in so long. I don't know if I can say boobs on
Fresh Air. That's fine. And speaking of boobs, you tell this great story. You're with a few of the guys, and they ask you to lift your blouse for them.
My T-shirt?
Yeah, your T-shirt, your blouse. Right, yeah.
That's okay.
Your blouse with the lace trim. Yeah, so they ask you to lift your T-shirt. Set the scene for us. What happened?
Well, we're sitting on the side of a mountain for weeks on end. There are 8 of us only. And we didn't see other people for days at a time other than the locals that we had some language barriers with. There's nothing to do. The key game that we played was to throw rocks at each other. It felt like being a child, but there's just nothing. You can only read so much and you have to interact with other people. So they'd play baseball with a rock and a stick. We'd sit there and throw rocks at each other. They'd throw rocks at my boobs. They'd throw rocks at each other's crotches. All of them, their pants had been ripped in the middle by then from wearing them constantly. They'd try to get the rocks through the hole. And as part of the boredom, eventually it devolved into, hey, show us your boobs. This was actually almost a daily question. But one day they actually started offering money, and it got up to $87 in a bag of M&Ms. Was the offer for me to show my boobs. And I declined. And I'm not ashamed of my body, and I'm not very hung up on issues of sexuality or nudity in a way that a lot of Americans seem to be. But I think the offering me money for it made it worse than if they had just asked nicely. It felt very degrading to be offered money to see my boobs. And I declined at that point.
Well, I was trying to imagine what it was like for you in that circumstance. And I imagine there were a lot of other times similar to this. So, like, on the one hand, I'm sure you really empathized with these guys. Like, they're away from women, they're young guys, they're horny.
It's not like women don't feel similar pressures.
Right. So, you know, on the one hand, you could be the kind of, like, sister of mercy making a sacrifice by showing them your breasts because these men are serving, they're sacrificing for our country. On the other hand, like, what does that do for you and for, you know, for what you'd be in their eyes and so on? So did you go through this long kind of long thought process about whether it would be the right thing or the wrong thing in these circumstances to just, like, lift your T-shirt and show them?
Sure, I had to think about that sort of thing a lot. Like, is it nice to just give in and give them that moment of happiness when they're in this difficult situation? Although, on the other hand, of course, I'm in the same difficult situation, and it's not like I don't have pressures. But guys would walk around without their shirts on, so I get to check out their pecs or whatever. I mean, to be very honest, of course, women in the situation have desires and miss their husbands or boyfriends as well. It isn't just the men who are over there saying, wow, I miss female company in intimate forms. The women feel the same pressure. The men just tend to be a little more outspoken about it. But then I did not want to change my relationship too much with these men by making a transition from being a sister with weird undertones to the relationship to being a full-on sex figure, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I overthink everything, so I definitely spent a long time thinking about all of these issues while I was there.
Now, are the kind of pressures that you're talking about an argument against men and women serving together in combat? Because I know that's how some people will hear it.
I don't think so, because when there is an actual combat situation going on, when there is a firefight, when the mission is happening, all of these things are gone. It's only when people have too much time on their hands and are sitting with nothing to do for days that these issues even become really apparent. And I believe that there have always been problems in the military when people have too much time and have nothing to do. It sounds as if in Vietnam there was a drug problem, and that may have been partly related to downtime when there was not an actual mission going on. And it's just a matter of things changing over time. Women being fully integrated is not going to be an easy process, just as it was not an easy process to integrate African Americans into the Army. But after some bumpiness, it's going to be fine. And at this point, with women at 15% of the military, there's no turning back.
My guest is Kayla Williams. Her new memoir is called Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Kayla Williams. Her new memoir is called Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army. And it's a memoir about her service as an Arabic linguist in the 101st Airborne Division. She was deployed to Kuwait in February of 2003, returned from Iraq in February of 2004. You say in your memoir that, you know, women where you were serving were either considered a bitch or a slut. If you didn't say yes to men, you were a bitch, and if you did, you were a slut. Did you feel that you were typed in any of those categories?
Yes. When I was friendly, smiling, outgoing, I would be considered a slut. And so partway through the deployment, I made a very conscious decision that I would rather be a bitch. I would rather be respected than liked. And that is a painful decision to make, because I believe that most people have a desire to be liked, but my desire to be respected was stronger, and there were certainly times that I wished that I was better liked, but I wanted to be respected for my ability to do my job and my leadership position at that point than anything else. That was what was important to me.
You know, one of the things you write about is how some of the military leadership just doesn't get certain things about women's needs and how they're different from men. So, you know, for example, you were in a convoy in which you were told you absolutely couldn't stop, not even to urinate. And you're right, the captain had given no consideration to the girls. Had anyone informed him that peeing in a bottle for a girl was not the same as it was for a guy? What could the captain have done? I mean, assuming that you really couldn't afford to make stops, what could the captain have done to have been more sensitive to the women in the convoy?
That's a great question. I have no idea. Luckily, a vehicle broke down. We stopped anyway, which happens almost all the time. Even when he made the announcement, I thought, you know, we will stop because something always breaks. But that's something that needs to be addressed at a greater level. I actually knew girls who would take adult protection, adult diapers, in case this happened. And female passengers could, in fact, pee in a bottle. But as a driver, it's tougher. After I was telling this story to somebody else, I talked to another woman who said, yeah, I did it. As a driver, I made it happen. So it can happen. It's just much tougher, much more acrobatic, I would imagine. I didn't do it. I didn't have to. But apparently it can be done. It's just much more difficult.
And would you like to think that somebody someplace within the military would design a good way of helping to make that happen in an easier way? It wouldn't be, I'm sure there's some kind of solution.
There's a NASA thing. There's this little, that I've read about, but mm-hmm. I've never used. They could possibly be issued. It might be handy. It's like a little cup with a tube that you can just kind of slide down there and, mm-hmm. you know, put the tube into a bottle.
Is this the kind of thing I know this thing probably sounds really trivial, but the thing is, I remember like when there were days when a lot of institutions didn't have ladies' rooms in it because only men had the jobs, and eventually, like Congress, right? So eventually, you have to kind of deal with that. There's women here too, and do you feel that there are certain things where the military hasn't quite gotten that, and that, you know, if there's women in there, there has to be certain changes that are made.
Sure.
Even like little easy ones, like finding a way to deal with what we're talking about here.
Right. One of the other really easy ones that would drive me nuts in Iraq was at the shopettes set up by AFIS, the little PXs, there were never small brown t-shirts or small socks. And there are small guys too, but more women are wearing small sizes than men. And there was never conditioner. It sounds so petty, I'm sure, but there was shampoo, but there was never conditioner. And I just wanted to be able to buy conditioner.
Were there tampons?
Yes, and condoms, amusingly enough.
Are you ever afraid that if you point out certain difficulties you have as a woman, that will be used as an argument against women in the military? You know, that if you should just swallow it, otherwise it will be used against you.
Yes, absolutely. That is a concern of mine. And I hope that doesn't happen, but I can definitely imagine it happening.
Kayla Williams' new memoir is called Love My Rifle More Than You. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor audio courses, including masterpieces of Western music, classics from the Baroque to the modern. Additional support for NPR comes from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Kayla Williams talks about being asked to assist in an interrogation by saying sexually humiliating things to naked Muslim prisoners. Also, Catherine Keener's performance in The 40-Year-Old Virgin gets our critic-at-large John Powers thinking about roles for women who don't fit the mold. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Kayla Williams. Her new memoir, Love My Rifle More Than You, is about being young and female in the Army. She enlisted for 5 years in 2000 at the age of 23. She spent about a year in Iraq and returned to the States in February 2004. She served as an Arabic linguist on a signals intelligence team with the 101st Airborne Division. Now, because you were an Arabic linguist, you were also asked to assist in interrogations at one point. What were you told to do?
Initially, I was under the impression that because I was a female Arabic linguist, I was being asked to help. And I thought that I would maybe be helping with interviewing a woman. I was completely wrong when I got down to the cage, that's what it's called, where the prisoners were being kept. I was told that I would sit in a room, a prisoner would be brought in blindfolded, his clothes would be removed, and then his blindfold would be removed in such a way that I would be the first thing that he saw in order to humiliate him, and that then I should mock him and try to break his spirit using the fact that I was a woman and an American woman to further humiliate him and try to break him down, and that they hoped this would help to break his resistance and he would answer any questions, and that there would be two men, that they would do this in a row. And it was very disturbing. I couldn't believe that it was happening. I felt as if, since I had agreed to come down and help, that I would go through with it.
Where and when was this?
This was in Mosul in probably late November of 2003.
So in following your instructions, what did you say to the prisoner?
Things along the lines of, do you think you can please a woman with that thing? It's interesting, although I do speak Arabic, the types of language that one would use to mock somebody else is not something I had really focused on. And even in English, trying to break someone by mocking them, especially sexually, is not something that I've ever given a lot of thought to. So I really didn't have a big repertoire in my mind of things I could say. And I felt so uncomfortable about it that I had no creativity for it. I had no inspiration to do it well. And I just felt so uncomfortable that I ended up spending a lot of time just kind of sitting there and watching the situation play out around me.
And what did you see as you sat there and watched? What else was going on?
The other U.S. soldiers in the room actually ended up flicking lit cigarette butts at the detainees, which I was horrified at. And at one point, one of the prisoners was slapped. He was handled very roughly, and it was very difficult to watch the prisoners. One of them cried, and I couldn't get past seeing their humanity. I could not see them just as prisoners or the enemy. I was looking at them, looking at their eyes, and seeing them as men, as other human beings like me. And it was so disturbing to me. I had a very hard time handling it.
When you tried the sexual humiliation thing, did you feel like, what kind of reaction did it get? It was supposed to break them down so finally they'd give information. Were you there long enough to know what the results actually were?
It was ineffective that day, at least while I was there, and as to whether or not there was any long-term effect, I have no idea. There are such strong stigmas attached to sharing information within the intelligence community. Like, I would never ask, what are you getting from your interrogations? It's just not my business.
Right.
And just as I would never tell what I was getting from my job to them, we have this heavy pressure to compartmentalize information, and things are need to know, and you use proper channels to report information up. So I have no idea if these men ever broke or had any intelligence value to begin with. I didn't think they looked like they were hardened criminals.
Now, you write that you told the interrogator that you didn't want to do this again because you found it so distasteful, but you stopped short of blowing the whistle. Had you thought about doing that? Did you think that this was against military regulations, and you know, wasn't violated regulations and should be reported? Did you have any sense of that one way or another?
I struggled with it internally a lot. I told the NCOIC, the non-commissioned officer in charge, that I thought that they were crossing the line, that I thought that what they were doing was probably violating the Geneva Conventions. I haven't read all of them, but we had gotten briefings on at least some of it. And I also told him that if someone came in not a terrorist, they would be a terrorist by the time they left, being treated this way. He said he knew, and he outranked me. He wasn't in my same unit. We didn't have the same commander. I am not familiar with the field manual governing interrogations. It's not my job. So I told him my opinions, and then waited and struggled internally a lot with, should I go forward? Should I do something? Should I talk to someone else? I had a very close friend that was at the same location at the same time, and she and I discussed it. Do we have an obligation to do anything? Is it going to be taken care of? And while we were still struggling with whether or not we should try to seek someone out to go forward with complaining about what we were seeing when we would go down there, even to use the phone or anything, there was an investigation, though we did not know that it was going on at the time. And at the conclusion of the investigation, military police were brought in to take over control of the cage. And so it seemed to me, to my great relief, the Army found the problem and fixed the problem. And I felt as if my obligation to do anything about it had been kind of relieved because it had been fixed.
Did you feel when you were asked to verbally, sexually humiliate prisoners that you were being abused as a woman?
No.
You didn't feel like you were being deployed in an incorrectly sexual way? And I mean in a way that took advantage of you.
It didn't occur to me at the time. I was so much more wrapped up in what was going on. I definitely just felt so much more shocked and disturbed by what was happening. It didn't occur to me to frame it in those terms.
Did your book have to pass through any kind of official military reading or censorship before publication?
Yes. Because I was military intelligence and had a security clearance, they had to verify that I did not give away any classified information.
Was there any questioning of you about this incident in which you were asked to verbally, sexually humiliate prisoners?
Yes. It started a very ugly situation. I was not aware that the investigation, though it determined that things were going wrong, was unable to determine who was doing anything wrong, because they don't tend to publish results of investigations, so I had no idea. And then when they were reviewing my book, this chapter was almost pounced upon. And the Army, being the Army, rather than somebody saying, hey, we really want to know who was doing what, can you talk to us about it? They said, we might court-martial you for failing to come forward and for your being there. And I had to get a lawyer and go through a huge, long ordeal of getting immunity and making a statement and going through exactly what happened. And it was very stressful and upsetting. I was shown by a friend that there had been an article written, I think an Associated Press reporter had requested any information under the Freedom of Information Act from the military about other instances of detainee abuse, and that this had come out, that these things had happened, had come out about the same time that they got the chapter of my book. And it seemed as if this probably encouraged them to want to wrap everything up or finish things. The way that they did it was so heavy-handed and unpleasant, though. I was very upset about it.
My guest is Kayla Williams. Her new memoir is called Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Kayla Williams. Her new memoir is called Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army. And she was sent to Kuwait in February of 2003, returned from Iraq in February 2004. Why did you join the military?
I had lost my job, which I loved. And
what was it?
I was actually working for a company in Florida that does the direct mail and telemarketing fundraising, database management, and gifts processing for a number of PBS and NPR stations nationwide.
Oh, no, really?
Yes. Yeah. I actually worked for a couple different PBS stations before then. And so my background is actually in public TV and radio. I've always loved it. But I lost my job, which I loved and had been very emotionally invested in. I wanted to continue my education, but did not want to work full-time and go to school full-time, as I did for a lot of my undergrad. I was in a complicated relationship that I wanted to get out of, but felt very trapped in. And I had this feeling that I was on a path in my life where I had not taken any risks. I had done what I knew I was good at, majored in lit, which was something that I loved. I loved reading books. They gave me a degree for reading books. It almost felt like I was tricking them to give me a college degree for doing something I loved so much. And then working for PBS, I was good at it, but it was easy for me. And I hadn't taken risks. I hadn't taken chances and risked losing everything. And I really felt as if I stayed on the path I was on, I was going to wake up and be 40 with a minivan, a white picket fence, a husband, 2.5 children, a dog, no idea how I had gotten there. I felt as if I had to break out of the rut that I was digging for myself and try something radically different. And the military has great benefits for college, and they were willing to pay me to learn a foreign language, which I thought was very exciting.
What are some of the ways that you feel you were changed, physically, emotionally, in terms of what you want out of life, by your service in the military and the time you spent in Iraq?
I'm stronger. That is the biggest and most obvious change, is that I know my own strength.
Are you talking about physically or beyond physically?
Both physically and mentally and emotionally. I know now that I can handle myself in a crisis. I'm tougher than I ever knew that I was. I can handle extremes of temperature and deprivation of, in terms of sleep and physical comforts, in a way that I had no idea that I would be able to not only handle, but handle fairly well. And I know how privileged we are in America. We are just desperately privileged. We have so much, and I have so much more of an appreciation for how much we really have, how wealthy we are as a nation.
Now, you're married now. You married
on Sunday.
On Sunday?
Yes.
Wow. God, congratulations.
Thank you.
And I think you met your husband at Fort Campbell this summer after you returned from Iraq. Do I have that right?
No. We met on the side of a mountain in Iraq.
Oh, okay. Tell us how you met.
I was on the side of a mountain with the team that I was on and another team of soldiers. And it was just the eight of us up there for many, many weeks. And the man who is now my husband was the platoon sergeant of the other team that was up there. He would bring them resupply and come up to deal with his soldiers periodically. We met. I was interested in him. We talked. There was often nothing to do but talk when you weren't working on the mountain. And I knew I wanted to get to know him better. Iraq, not a terribly romantic place, not exactly a place we could go on dates or anything. And then he was very severely injured in October of 2003 and came home. He was sent home at that point to get medical treatment. He was very lucky to live. And he got back to Fort Campbell in probably late January of 2004, and then I came back in February of 2004, and we started dating at that point and got married just a few days ago.
So you weren't really a couple in Iraq?
No.
Right. So he was severely injured and probably still requires medical help?
Yes, he is still in the Army. They have not finished medically boarding him or medically retiring him, and it is a very long time. It should have happened already. It's very frustrating for us to try to deal with it. And he still is getting some treatment, though he's doing much better than anybody had, I think, initially hoped. He had shrapnel go into his skull, and he's missing parts of his skull. He has plates and still has some difficulties, both from the physical injury and the psychological after effects that so many soldiers are struggling with coming home.
How are you finding the military health benefits?
It has been a disaster. I believe that the system is overwhelmed by the volume of soldiers coming back injured. I'm trying to be generous. The actual medical care that he got when he was hurt was phenomenal. He lived, which is fantastic. He has had far fewer long-term problems resulting from the extent of his injuries than you might expect. He's been very lucky. But dealing with the problems that he does have, has not gone well. He has horrible headaches, and the pain management has not happened at all. And also just, again, the psychological after effects that he deals with, that a lot of soldiers coming back deal with in terms of post-traumatic stress disorder. There really has not been a good system in place to try to help. I know that the military is struggling to catch up and to do the right thing, but it's taken a very, very long time, and the lack of support for family members is also very difficult. He has a traumatic brain injury. He has PTSD. That's tough on me, too. And there isn't a support system in place to tell me what's normal or what isn't. And it's also difficult because injuries that are that severe affect a whole family. And it's very tough going to Walter Reed with him on a regular basis and seeing the number of amputees and just very severely injured soldiers. This war is having a terrible toll. We're lucky in that increases in battlefield technology, helicopters to evac people more quickly, the fact that so many soldiers have been trained in basic life-saving techniques and immediate first aid, and the fact that flak vests and Kevlar helmets save lives that would have been lost in any previous combat. That's great. It's wonderful. These people are so lucky to live. But they're living with injuries that are really devastating, that would have killed people at any other war. And so you have so many soldiers coming home with very, very severe injuries. I think it's up to, for every one soldier that is killed, it's more than 10 are grievously wounded.
Do you know what you're going to do now?
No. I know that I have a book tour coming up, and I have not gotten a job because I didn't feel it would be very fair to get a job after getting out of the Army and say, okay, by the way, after I work for 3 months, I'm going to need about 6 weeks off. It didn't seem like it would be fair to an employer. Plus, dealing with Brian's issues and trying to get him out of the Army with the compensation that he deserves has been very time-consuming. And planning a wedding apparently takes up a lot more time than I had really imagined. So after all of this with the book dies down a little, I think then I will be able to try to figure out where I want to go with my life and see what doors the book opens and what doors the book closes. It may definitely close off some career paths for me, even as it may open others.
Well, I want to wish you good luck, and I wish your husband good luck as well.
Thank you very much.
Kayla Williams' new memoir is called Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, 6 Feet Under and the 40-Year-Old Virgin get our critic-at-large John Powers thinking about unconventional actresses and roles. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. The number one movie this week is The 40-Year-Old Virgin, about a grown man whose buddies help him cross the final sexual frontier. The comedy may sound like a classic guy movie, but our critic at large, John Power, says it got him thinking about actresses and the women of 6 feet under.
In the unexpectedly smart and funny new comedy, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Steve Carell stars as a middle-aged guy who's never slept with a woman. His love interest is played by Catherine Keener, and this is striking for a couple of reasons. For starters, she's age-appropriate. This is not one of those movies where some 40-year-old goofball winds up bedding a 22-year-old hottie. But it's even more striking because Keener is, well, Catherine Keener. Don't get me wrong. I mean this as a compliment. You see, I love Catherine Keener, and I'm not the only one. Over the last 15 years, this wonderful actress has built up an enormous reservoir of affection among people who go to the movies regularly. We appreciate the distinctive tang she brings to every performance, from the bitchy body traveler in Being John Malkovich to the haplessly artistic housewife in Lovely and Amazing. Keener shines in four very different movies this year alone: The Interpreter, The Ballad of Jack and Rose, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, and the upcoming Capote. And it's easy to see why filmmakers keep hiring her. She's sharp, vivid, and emotionally real. All her characters have filigrees and edges. They're human. Now, you might hope such talents would have propelled Keener to Hollywood stardom. After all, she has incomparably more screen presence than Kate Hudson, say, or Jennifer Garner. But Hollywood doesn't know what to do with offbeat women who don't fit the usual mold. In fact, the very qualities that make her special can sometimes be a liability, as she told Terry on this show 3 years ago.
I was told, not this, not pretty enough, a lot of times, especially for television, I got the note back was that I came across as too hard. I know it's hard to believe, considering the parts I get usually are pretty tough, but I think that they were too much for, television. I think they want, even if the character is described as a hardened person, they want her really soft, in my opinion.
Right.
Hard, but not like life hard.
Of course, Keener's not the only actress to face such attitudes. This is an era filled with superb performers like Hope Davis, Rachel Griffiths, and Tilda Swinton, who have the capacity to carry a movie, but rarely if ever get to. They're too edgy, too intelligent, or too life-hard. The industry fears that such aggressive female characters will scare off teenage boys, whose ideal women seem to have escaped from a video game or comic book, still clad in scanty costumes. The only scary women that Hollywood embraces these days carry ice picks or are busy killing Bill. Needless to say, it wasn't always so. While we like to flatter ourselves that we're incomparably more sophisticated than those benighted yokels who lived during the Dark Ages, back when movies were still shot in black and white, the 30s and 40s were actually bursting with great female stars like Betty Davis, Joan Crawford, Barbara Stanwyck, and Katharine Hepburn. Pitched to an audience of adults, their performances bristled with the kind of wit, ambition, ferocity, and intelligence that would be thought off-putting in our supposedly post-feminist days. If they were working now, they'd almost certainly be vying for the character roles played by Keener, Davis, and Griffiths, the mouthy girlfriend, the bitter sister, the heroine's ruthless career woman boss. Which helps explain why so many of my women friends mourn the passing of 6 Feet Under, the HBO series that ended last Sunday with tombstones sprouting like mushrooms. Although women are all over TV, usually playing cops, caricatured sexpots, or screwball chicks, there's never been a TV show that celebrated a broader range of unconventional women, be it Frances Conroy's melancholy mom, Lauren Ambrose's angst-ridden photographer Claire, Patricia Clarkson's pill-popping new-age loony, the sappy little ferret Maggie who sleeps with Nate, or Rachel Griffith's Brenda, perhaps the show's most resonant character, who battles to transform her life from a symphony of self-destructive self-loathing into something resembling stability. What all these women share is that in one way or another, they're intelligent, hyperdramatic, and not always likable. What some people think of as difficult. And while I can't imagine Catherine Keener having lunch with the Desperate Housewives or being invited to cocktails with the Sex and the City gals, she'd have been right at home with the uncomfortable silences of the Fisher family on 6 Feet Under. Of course, now that this show is dead and buried, you have to wonder, where will all the passionate and brainy, all the difficult women go?
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and the author of Soar Winners, which has been published in an expanded paperback edition. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Mike and Scott. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The new film, The Constant Gardener, is based on the bestseller by John le Carré. On the next Fresh Air, we'll hear from le Carré, the author of many classic spy novels, including The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, and Smiley's People. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.